Welcome to NACSW's Podcast of the Month. Our podcast program makes available recordings of a wide variety of NACSW presentations and discussions on topics of particular interest to Christians and social work. Our Podcast of the Month program features a new podcast every 30 days for your listening pleasure. We hope you enjoy today's podcast.
This audio conference workshop will explore the HIV epidemic in America and how it affects the work social workers will likely encounter with HIV-infected and affected clients. In particular, this workshop will focus on crisis intervention work, emphasizing the most common crises HIV-infected and affected individuals face, including the ways in which an HIV-positive diagnosis can impact his or her questions of religion and spirituality. I'm delighted to present our speaker, Allison Tan.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, so much for calling in. And I completely understand the whole background noise situation because, like Rick said, I have a brand new baby, about 4 weeks old, and I'm downstairs and he's upstairs with a best friend who is wonderful and came over to watch him. So hopefully you will not hear him. But if you do, I apologize. We're doing the best we can. So I'm really excited about this audio conference for a number of reasons, you know, not the least of which is for the last month or so, I haven't really had the chance to have an intelligent conversation with anyone about anything professional because I've been in mommy mode. So looking forward to kind of sharing some things with you all today. So I just thought I would start by telling you a little bit about kind of who I am and where this audio conference kind of originated from, just so you have a sense of kind of where I'm coming from. So I probably, you know, it would be wonderful if I could kind of know who all of you are that are out there on the phone, because I'm sure that some of us have passed each other at NACSW conferences and things like that along the way. So some of you may know a little bit about me, but just tell you a little bit about my HIV experience. I have a bachelor's and a master's and now a PhD in social work. And so after getting my master's degree, I came here to Chicago and was the director of HIV services at a health center here on the west side of Chicago for about 6 years. And so in that capacity, ran HIV and substance abuse programs. It was a small community mental health center, a faith-based community mental health center. And so ran the HIV services there, and that ranged from everything from medical care to mental health services, psychosocial services. We had a huge testing and counseling program, kind of an all-encompassing HIV program. And so ran that for about 6 years, and a lot of the stories and definitely all of the clients' stories that I'm going to share as a part of this audio conference come from that work. I left there and went and worked for the AIDS Foundation of Chicago here in the city for about a year. They hired me as a consultant, actually, when they were implementing a new model of HIV case management for the city, a medical case management model. And so had the opportunity to work with them for about a year, helping to kind of oversee that process. And right about the time that concluded, I got married and then started the PhD program at Loyola. I just finished up that PhD program in October. So that's kind of where my HIV experience comes from. My dissertation, obviously, was related to HIV stuff as well, although not this crisis intervention stuff specifically. And so that's kind of where I come from in terms of my HIV experience. And like I said, I'll be sharing a number of stories kind of from that work along the way. So that's where the HIV side of this audio conference comes from. And then where does the crisis intervention piece come from? So the crisis intervention piece came much more recently. I, as Rick said in the introduction, have been working as an adjunct instructor while I was completing my PhD. And an adjunct instructor both at Loyola and at Dominican. And one of the classes that I started teaching at Dominican kind of fell into my lap was their crisis intervention class. And so it was quite honestly an interesting experience and opportunity for me because I don't typically teach the practice classes. I consider myself, even though I have a lot of practice experience, I consider myself much more of kind of a macro level, policy level social worker. But was offered to teach the crisis intervention class at Dominican, and so I did that. And so anytime, my students will tell you, anytime you get a class with me, no matter what the class is, there's always going to be at least 1 week where we talk about HIV stuff. And so a large part of this audio conference actually comes from the lecture that I put together for the crisis intervention class to talk to them about working with HIV-positive clients. So that's kind of where it originated from. And so you'll see in the, if you're looking at the PowerPoint, you might see in the background these two Chinese characters, and you might be thinking, what does that have to do with anything? Let me tell you a little bit about them to get started. Those Chinese characters taken together, those two characters are make up the word crisis in Chinese. And I think it's fascinating because the two characters individually, the first one means danger. And the second one means opportunity. And in the Chinese language, when you put danger and opportunity together, you get the word crisis. I've always just found that to be kind of beautiful and have really worked hard to kind of use that as the framework to teach my students about crisis intervention. And I think it's especially true when we talk about crisis intervention with HIV-positive clients. That every crisis that we face with clients or every crisis that we face in our own lives, a crisis is kind of a turning point where there is obviously danger, but there's also opportunity for growth, opportunity for change. So I think the exciting part of crisis intervention work from a social work standpoint is the opportunity to kind of tap into that opportunity that clients have for this crisis to kind of be maybe a turning point for the better. So I left those Chinese characters throughout the presentation in the background just to kind of frame our discussion a little bit. So let me just say one more thing and then I'll flip the slide and we'll get started. Those of you who know me know that I'm actually a very informal sort of presenter. And so the audio conference format is a little daunting for me because, first of all, I really like to see everyone's faces. And secondly, I like for you to be able to talk to me whenever you want to. But certainly with this many people on the call, I think we have more than 40 people on the call, I understand the need for kind of keeping the background noise down. That being said, I will at several points throughout the workshop probably ask Rick to take the meeting off so that you all can kind of ask questions and kind of talk back to me because I really do work better that way. So just know if I say something and you have a question or a comment, write it down or, you know, keep it close and it won't be too long before I give you a chance to kind of talk back and give me your thoughts on things. We'll make it as interactive as we can in this audio conference format. So,
Allison, can I interrupt for 1 second?
Absolutely.
Why don't we test to see? It is in the mode now that if someone wanted to make a comment, if
they can press star 6.
Right. Luann, would you mind just trying that? Would you mind pressing star 6 on your phone and seeing if we can hear you to ask Allison a question?
Yeah, it just said I was unmuted.
Okay.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
So we're in a mode where folks, anyone on the call, if they wanted to interrupt Allison, it's a lot of fun.
Wonderful.
You can just press star 6 and you'll be able to be heard by the whole call. But again, I would suggest, and I'll say that to you now, Luann, just press star 6 so you're unmuted except when you have specifically something to say. And we'll use that as a way to try to keep things as open as possible, Allison, for you.
That's
right,
great. Thank you so much, Rick.
I mute myself by doing the same thing.
Yes.
All right. Okay, well, that's wonderful. So please feel free to jump in at any time and ask questions or share comments. I would actually really appreciate that. Okay, so now you see kind of the overview for today's audio conference. We're going to start with a pretty thorough history of HIV in America, and I'll tell you why we're doing that. because, you know, I think on a call this big, there are probably some people on the call who have a pretty thorough background in HIV, feel like they know quite a bit about it. But for every one of those people, my experience tells me there are probably at least two people for every one expert that really doesn't know a whole lot about the HIV epidemic. And that's kind of, quite honestly, been my experience at a number of NACSW conferences that I presented at, a number of other conferences. And so I've just kind of learned along the way that any time I talk about HIV in any capacity, it's helpful for us to just start and make sure everyone has the same kind of basic understanding about the history of HIV and a little bit about the nature of the HIV epidemic. So that's why we start where we do. And so for those of you that do consider yourselves experts, feel free to hit star 6 and share along the way and know that we'll get to the crisis intervention piece as soon as we're finished with that. So and I'll also say the other reason that I really want to spend some time talking about the history of the HIV epidemic is because, and I'll try and make these connections along the way, is because I think that understanding the history of the epidemic is really important to understanding the crises that people living with HIV and AIDS face today. It's really important to understand kind of where the epidemic came from, because it helps us to understand where the epidemic is now, and that in turn helps us understand a little bit and empathize a little bit with what it's like to live with HIV, here in 2012. So try and keep that in mind kind of as we're going through the history. So like I said, we'll start with the history, and then we'll get into some specific thoughts and kind of content that I have related to crisis intervention. That's when we're going to I'm going to identify a handful of the main kind of crisis points that you may experience with someone living with HIV. We'll talk specifically about that kind of work. And then at the end, I'm going to share, as much as time allows, we'll see a number of kind of vignettes, cases of clients that I've dealt with along the years. Like I said, most of them from my time in direct practice, just to kind of put a face as much as we can to some of the content that we've talked about. And the final slide does leave you with some resources for future use, especially for those of you who don't necessarily work in HIV per se, but, you know, may encounter an HIV-positive client along the way and feel like you need more information. I did include some kind of references and websites that I have found to be most credible that you could go to for future information. So that's where we're going for today. So let's launch into history. I think I have three or four slides of the history of the HIV epidemic, starting way back at the beginning, 1981. So in 1981, we didn't have HIV as a term, but what happened in 1981 was that there were 121 deaths that occurred that were blamed on what was then called gay cancer, or GRID, and GRID stood for gay-related immunodeficiency. And so obviously at that time, as the names imply, those 121 deaths were all gay cancer infected individuals, meaning all of them at that time, the common factor was homosexuality, or at least homosexual activity. And so that's where it comes from, which probably is not that surprising to most of you, but I think a really, really important place to start from in understanding what it's like today. So by 1982, GRID was renamed AIDS, which stands for the Acquired Immunodeficiency Syndrome. And that's a pretty huge turning point, because what happened at that time was that the CDC recognized that sexual activity and infected blood were recognized as causes of these deaths. At that time, we're now up to 285 cases of AIDS in 17 states and 5 European countries. So the disease was renamed because they found that there were people who were not engaging in homosexual activity that were in fact coming down with the same condition. So that was in 1982. 1985, another major thing happened, and that is that we started testing HIV blood or we started testing blood for HIV. So this was the very first HIV blood test that was available. So that means that for 4 years, we didn't have any real test to diagnose people who were HIV AIDS infected. They were kind of doing it at that time based on symptomology and calling it what it was. And so then they had a blood test, and the very first thing that happened once we had a test for this condition was that all blood banks in the United States and most blood banks around the world in 1985 began routine screening of all donated blood for HIV. So that's a major turning point. Many of you probably remember, and we'll talk about him in a little bit, but many of you probably remember Ryan White. Ryan White was a young boy who became infected with HIV in the 80s, and he became infected with HIV because he was a hemophiliac, which is a condition that causes you to bleed for your blood not to clot, and so they require lots and lots of blood transfusions. And so he obviously got HIV because of a blood transfusion. And so really important to know that in 1985, they started routinely testing blood in blood banks, and there hasn't been a case of blood transfusion infected HIV patients since 1987. So, and that's something that is a pretty big myth that's still out there, that people think that that's how you can get it, but it really isn't anymore. And so that happened in 1985. 1986, a couple interesting things happened. One interesting thing is that the Surgeon General, who was C. Everett Koop at the time, sent AIDS information through the mail to all U.S. households. That's a pretty huge turning point, because it was the government recognizing that that this HIV AIDS epidemic was significant, and the government recognizing that it wasn't in fact targeting, you know, some high risk, you know, group that no one wanted to talk about, but that it was affecting everyone, and so they sent out AIDS information more broadly to all U.S. households, which it was a pretty big turning point. You'll see there on the slide that it also says HIV-2 is discovered in West Africa. Not hugely important for the course of this discussion, but just put it in there. We can talk more about it later, but there are two strands of HIV. It doesn't make a whole lot of difference nowadays because everything is kind of so mixed, but HIV-2 was a strand of HIV that was found specifically in Africa and affected the African epidemic primarily. So then in 1987, this is a major, major turning point in the HIV epidemic. 1987, the FDA approved the first drug for the treatment of HIV/AIDS. It's called AZT. So we need to stop here and talk a little bit about AZT. So 1987, huge moment for people living with HIV and AIDS, because it was the very first drug that was available, and that's seemingly really good news. But before you get too excited and think this is fantastic and it changed the course of the epidemic, it's really important to understand what AZT was. So it was the very first drug. It made a huge difference for a lot of people living with HIV and AIDS, because up until this point, there was absolutely no treatment, and people became very, very acutely sick and died very, very quickly after that. So the HIV treatment prior to 1987 was really nothing more than palliative care. It was really just, you know, social workers and doctors helping people die because we didn't have any treatment. And so AZT was really, really significant in that respect, because it was helping people live longer. However, the side effects of AZT are horrific, were horrific, still are. And so lest we get too excited about, oh, we put everyone on AZT and everyone got better, people may have been living longer, but most people who were infected at that time and took AZT tell pretty terrible stories about the quality of life really being very, very poor on AZT. The side effects were really, really terrible. A lot of kind of nausea and diarrhea and just kind of wasting And AZT also in 1987 was a huge pill burden for people. It was like 24 pills taken, you know, every 4 or 6 hours, and most people had had beepers that were provided by the pharmaceutical companies that would go off every 4 hours to remind them to take their medication because it was so frequent. So the quality of life that people had on AZT, certainly questionable. Nonetheless, it's a really, really big moment, and we'll talk about how AZT transformed into the treatment that we know today. So moving on a little bit in history. So history continues. 1990. In 1990, Congress passed what was then called the Ryan White Comprehensive AIDS Resources Emergency Act. We call it the Ryan White Care Act in the field. And so obviously this is named in honor of Ryan White, that boy we were just talking about. This is, and it still is, there's a new name for it, and we'll get to that in a second. But this piece of legislation is the single largest piece of HIV-related legislation federally. And virtually all, if not all, HIV services that are funded by the government are funded directly through this piece of legislation. So it's huge, hugely important for the care of people living with HIV and AIDS. And so it started in 1990. Millions and millions of dollars, billions of dollars in some cases, every year get funneled through that act. And so just make a mental note of the name, the Comprehensive AIDS Resource Emergency Act. That's what it was called in 1990, and we'll come back to what it's called now, and I think you'll see some of the differences, and I think they have direct impact on crisis intervention work. And so by 1991, just to continue to kind of paint the picture, there were 10 million people infected with HIV worldwide, 1 million of them in the United States, and 36,000 Americans had died of HIV. That's a really, really significant increase from those numbers that were on the previous slide when you think that in 1982 there were only 285 cases. So you can see that the epidemic was just growing hugely during this time. In 1994, speaking of the epidemic growing hugely, by 1994, AIDS was the leading cause of death in individuals between the age of 25 and 44 in the United States, the leading cause of death. More people were dying of AIDS than cardiovascular disease, than cancer, than anything else in that age group, which is staggering, mind-blowing to me. And so during that same year, AZT, that terrible drug that I told you about, became routinely used for the treatment of pregnant women with HIV. I know that sounds pretty terrible given all of the side effects that I talked about, but it was also really, really hugely important for the reduction of perinatal transmission of HIV from mother to child. Even one dose of AZT given to HIV-infected women at the time of delivery significantly reduces the risk of them transmitting HIV to their children. And so when we realized that in 1984 and started using that, we saw the numbers of perinatal HIV transmission start to drop pretty significantly. Those numbers aren't actually in this PowerPoint, but it's really, really interesting to look them up. And it's another one of those kind of misnomers, I think, at this point. People assume that perinatal transmission occurs a lot more often than it does. And actually, I think the statistics the last time I saw them are incredibly low, like 1 to 2 infants born with HIV nationally every year. So we've done a really, really good job of routinely screening pregnant women for HIV and giving them HIV prophylaxis treatment at the time of delivery, during prenatal care, if we can catch them that early. And so for the most part, the transmission of HIV to from mom to baby is relatively limited at this point, which is great news. So then moving on to 1996. So 1996, this is when AZT kind of transforms pretty significantly. So in 1996, we had the first what's called a highly active antiretroviral or HART cocktail passed by the FDA. Let me tell you a little bit about what that means. So what happened was AZT, which at the time was the only medication, in 1996, AZT became not the only option. And so what happened was we started to discover a number of other medications that were also effective and that started to become on the market after being approved by the FDA. And what they realized was that the most effective treatment for HIV is actually a cocktail of medications. So not to get into like the medical technical aspects because it's beyond the scope of this audio conference. But suffice it to say that that 1996, when we started using cocktails for the treatment of HIV, it made a huge difference in the medical outcomes for people. So in 1996, AIDS was the eighth leading cause of death in the United States. So then I want you to just look at what happens 1 year later after the HART cocktails became available. The government spent about $4.5 billion on HIV treatment in 1997. I'll tell you that a large amount of that money was funding the medications. Medications are very, very expensive. As a result of HART, in 1 year, between 1996 and 1997, AIDS dropped to the 14th leading cause of death from the 8th in 1996 and dropped from the 1st to the 5th leading cause of death for individuals between the ages of 25 and 44. That is an unbelievable change in 3 years between 94 and 97 and attributed almost entirely to the advent of HART. And so what's important to understand, I think, for the purposes of this discussion about crisis intervention and HIV related to this point is that with the advent of HART and with the advancement in better treatment for HIV, people were living longer, the health outcomes were much better, and that's all wonderful, wonderful news. But the flip side of it is that when the epidemic transformed from being kind of an acute epidemic where the goal of treatment was palliative care and we just helped people die, and all of a sudden HART comes on the scene and HIV becomes a chronic disease. And that's wonderful news from a medical outcomes standpoint, but it also means we have lots and lots more people living with HIV than we ever did before, and they're living with HIV. They're not dying from HIV anymore. And while that's wonderful, it presents a number of additional challenges. And so, in a lot of ways, if you think about it, if we were having this audio conference in the early 90s, I don't even know what I would have said about crisis intervention work with HIV-positive clients, because the crisis was they were dying, and that was about it. And now, as you'll see when we start to talk about some of the specific HIV crises, the crisis isn't that they're dying anymore. The crises that, and there are multiple crisis points that we'll talk about, but the crises that HIV-positive individuals face these days are not because they're dying. They're them figuring out how to live with this disease. And it is a chronic disease now. It's treated as a chronic disease in the medical community. And it makes a really, really big difference. So that's a definite turning point for the purposes of crisis intervention work. So I want you to kind of keep that in mind as we continue. All right, so then into the 2000s. This is my last history slide. Into the 2000s. In 2000, the HIV supervirus emerged. Some of you may remember this. It was pretty widely publicized in the media. And the HIV supervirus was a strand of the HIV virus which all of a sudden people were becoming infected with, and it was resistant to all medications. It was a pretty huge crisis in and of itself in the medical community. And I'll try and describe in layperson's terms what it was that happened. So what it was that happened was that individuals living with HIV were doing something called serosorting. And what serosorting is, they thought, and you got to give them credit, because these people living with HIV thought they were doing a good thing. Because what they started to do was they started to serosort, meaning they were HIV positive, and so they would find other people who were HIV positive, and they would say, I'm HIV positive and you're HIV positive, so we can engage in sexual activity, exchange needles together without worrying about infecting each other because we're both infected. And so what was happening is they thought that it was kind of, a way to be safer. But what we didn't realize about the HIV virus at the time was that every strand is different. And so what they were doing was cross-contaminating each other. And so, just not to belabor the point, but just to kind of make you understand. If I'm HIV positive and my strand of HIV is resistant to drug A, B, and C, and I meet someone who is HIV positive and their strand of the virus is resistant to drugs X, Y, and Z, and we engage in sexual activity, we cross-contaminate each other, and now I am resistant to A, B, and C, X, Y, and Z, and so is he. And so what was happening is that was happening over and over again, and people were being infected with versions of the virus that were already resistant to all medications, which was really, really problematic, obviously, from a medical standpoint. It's also really important, again, you might be listening to me and thinking I didn't sign up for an audio conference about the medical implications of HIV, and I understand that. But before you think that I'm getting too technical, I want you to understand that one of the main reasons that I bring this up for the purposes of crisis intervention is because, again, this new piece of information affects how people living with HIV view their disease and view their options and understand kind of what they have to do to keep themselves safe. And so I think it is a really important point to understand. So moving on, in 2001, the AIDS Drug Assistance Program was added to the CARE Act. We call it ADAP. Pretty significant because ADAP covers people's medications for HIV. And so what this did was allow most individuals to gain access to HIV medications regardless of their ability to pay. The ADAP is basically a program for low-income folks or uninsured folks who can't afford HIV medications. And so, again, I put this in for a very specific reason in this discussion about crisis intervention because we'll talk if we get to it about a client who faced this as an issue in my practice. And what we found is one of my favorite things to say to HIV positive people, especially, like I said, I was the director of HIV services, on the west side here in Chicago, in a neighborhood that's, incredibly poor, incredibly, uninsured, and, a very kind of rough urban environment. And one of my favorite things to say to HIV positive people, when they would find out that they were HIV positive, and they would say things like, well, I'm not going to be able to afford medication, or, they always go back to Magic Johnson, and they would say, well, yeah, Magic Johnson, he's not dying, but that's because he can afford all the fancy medications. And one of my favorite things to say to people was to look at them and say, if you want to be on exactly the same drugs that Magic Johnson is on, I can do that for you. Because that's what the drug assistance program did for people. It gave them access to HIV medications, the same HIV medications that anyone else had access to. And that became a really big turning point for folks. So moving on, 2002, we established the AIDS Education and Training Centers. These are training centers that they're regional, and they're set up all throughout the country, and their express purpose is to provide education and resources to primary care providers, to the medical community. Again, the reason this was important in 2002 is because people were living with HIV, and so we recognized that doctors needed to be better educated on HIV-related issues beyond medical care so that they could help their patients to kind of live life better. And so those training centers are regional, and they still exist today. In 2004, just to kind of finish up our history lesson, and then we'll get to the crisis intervention stuff. In 2004, we developed the first HIV saliva test and a finger prick test, which was actually a rapid HIV test. They were both approved by the FDA. This is a very important point from the standpoint of HIV testing, and we'll talk in a second. HIV testing and the point of diagnosis is obviously one of the main crisis points that we face with people living with HIV. And these testing options, especially the rapid test, dramatically changed how we work with clients around the issues of diagnosis. Because that first blood test that was developed back in the 80s and 90s, that we used in the 80s and 90s, it was a blood test, like most blood tests that you get at your doctor's office, where they would take the blood and they would send you on your way and your results would be back in, you know, a week or two. And what happened with this rapid test was that all of a sudden we were able to finger prick people and have them wait 15 minutes and then give them their test results, which had its pros and cons, to say the least. I could do a whole audio conference just on that. But the rapid testing dramatically changed, I think, especially the social work kind of role in terms of HIV diagnosis, new HIV diagnosis, because we realized that while that's wonderful to be able to give results in 15 minutes, we really have to make sure that people are ready to receive those results. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second when we get to the crisis intervention piece. So in 2005, yes?
I just one quick note. If you could be not quite as close to your phone receiver. We rarely have difficulty with a speaker being too loud, but your microphone's so sensitive it's picking up pretty strongly. So if you could just back off the microphone a little bit or speak a little softer, there'd be less sort of static that's created in the system. Sorry to interrupt.
Okay. No problem. I can do that. So in 2005, the AZT patent expired. And what that allowed for was generic heart drugs to be on the market. Again, just another step towards making the HIV, the AIDS drug assistance program more accessible to people. And 2006, which is my last point in our history lesson, 2006, a couple of interesting things. One is that we developed our first one pill once a day heart regimen. It's called Atripla. It's a single drug that basically combines three drugs into one. And so people living with HIV are now able to take one pill once a day as their treatment. And if you remember back to what I said about AZT and kind of the pill burden and side effects associated with AZT, you can see what a long way we've come with HIV treatment. People used to have to take 24 pills, every 4 hours all day long. And now they're able to take one pill once a day with Atripla. And that really changes the quality of life for folks. It makes a really, unbelievable difference. And then the last thing that I want to say, and this transitions us pretty nicely into the crisis intervention piece, and that is that the CARE Act, the Ryan White CARE Act, which remember stood for Comprehensive AIDS Resources Emergency Act, was reauthorized by Congress in 2006 with some substantial changes, and including a name change. And so that piece of legislation still exists, but it's now called the Ryan White Treatment Modernization Act. And I just want to say something kind of about the name change and kind of what that implies. Like I said, I consider myself a macro level social worker, and my favorite classes to teach are the policy classes. And when I talk with my students from a policy standpoint about HIV, I make a really big deal out of this name change, because you can tell a lot about the policy by looking at its name. And so what happened was, we stopped viewing HIV as, and I shouldn't say we here because I don't agree with it, but Congress, the medical community, whoever we want to blame, stopped seeing HIV as an emergency. And so they took out the emergency from the name and started calling it the Treatment Modernization Act. And what happened as a result of that was that a lot of the psychosocial services, a lot of the ancillary services that were previously funded under the CARE Act are no longer funded under the Treatment Modernization Act. 75% of all government funding under the new act has to go towards medically necessary services. kind of core medical services. And so there was a lot of backlash and continues to be a lot of difficulty in the social service community over how to provide all of the things that we know are really, really important to helping people kind of navigate what it means to live with HIV in a time when resources have become a lot more limited. And so that's a kind of an important point as a, by way of transition. Okay, so if there aren't any questions about history or any comments, we'll move on to crisis intervention. So this slide says general thoughts on crisis intervention and HIV. And so before, I'm sorry?
Yep, I'm sorry. My name's Crystal, and I am a senior in my BSW program at Southern Adventist University. I just finished up my policy class last semester, and we actually were able to go to Washington, D.C., and talk to some of our congressmen about a policy that we researched. Can you explain real quick again the significance of that name change? I was trying to write it down as you were speaking.
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. And I get geeked up because I like policy questions. So you score points with me. So basically what I'm saying is, so the old name was the Comprehensive AIDS Resources Emergency Act. And the main reason they changed the name was because the argument that they used was that HIV is no longer an emergency. That's kind of that's what was said over and over again. It's not an emergency anymore, which I certainly sort of agree with, right? Like we talked about, it did change from being kind of an acute condition to a chronic condition. So I sort of understand where they're coming from, but they took out the emergency. And when they took out the emergency, they took out a lot of the psychosocial services that used to be funded under the Act. And the main emphasis of the new Ryan White Act focuses on treatment modernization, and so it focuses only on medical care, which is wonderful because it means people are getting great medical care, but it means that people aren't able to access some of the counseling services that they used to access. They're not able to access some of the housing services that used to be funded. Transportation got pretty severely cut. Child care got pretty severely cut, kind of all of those ancillary services, because now there's a stipulation that says 75% of all HIV funding has to be for medical services only. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. No, great question. Okay. So moving on, to the crisis intervention piece. So like I said, this slide says general thoughts on crisis intervention and HIV. And so before I talk about the specific crises that people living with HIV face, I wanted to just make a few points about what social workers kind of need to understand about HIV and crisis. We must understand the nature of the stigma associated with HIV, as well as the consequences of HIV that people living with HIV and AIDS face. We need to understand those things as much as we possibly can as social workers so that we can really understand the crises that they face. So I just wanted to make some comments about some of these bullet points before we move on. So the first one is understanding stigma. Like I said, I don't want to belabor this point, but it's really important that those of us who have not been personally infected or affected by HIV, you know, maybe have never met anyone who's HIV positive or, you know, just aren't really connected with that community, it's really important that we take some time to, you know, attend audio conferences like this, trainings, you know, read things to understand the stigma that people living with HIV face, even today in 2012. And that stigma is both stigma that they might face personally at like a family level and also kind of institutional discrimination that occurs on a societal level around HIV. It is just supremely disappointing to me that in 2012 we're still talking about the stigma associated with living with HIV, but we are. you know, the, like I said, the reason I start the history lecture where I do is because it's really important to understand that this epidemic started as GRID, right? It started as gay cancer. It started as this gay disease. But it's transformed so much since then. And yet, in 2012, it's unbelievable how much stigma is still associated with living with HIV because of the connection to the homosexual community. That's just one example of the stigma associated with living with HIV, but just really important that we as social work practitioners take the time to understand that stigma and how it affects people. Secondly, should educate ourselves on the consequences of HIV. I separated that into two bullet points here. The first says emotional and social consequences. And those are consequences like being shunned by their family for being HIV positive, being shunned by their friends, people that have kind of turned their backs on them because they're HIV positive. To make the kind of Christian connection, being shunned by their church for being HIV positive. The number of people who I have talked to who share stories about being connected to a church and then coming out with their HIV diagnosis and having that church turn their back on them is staggering. And so those consequences are something that we definitely need to keep in mind, as well as the physical consequences of living with HIV. Yes, the health outcomes are getting better, but there are still kind of physical side effects of medications and just as the disease progresses that are important to understand. There's also an educational component that I think is absolutely critical to understanding and to kind of potentially working to eliminate some of the crises associated with living with HIV. And what I mean by that is dispelling myths and giving hope to people around HIV and what it is and what it isn't, it makes a huge, unbelievable, immeasurable difference in people's lives. We've talked already in this audio conference about a number of kind of myths, I think, that still exist. There are so many of them that we don't have time to go into. But one of the things that I have found to be most empowering and most helpful in working with HIV-positive people is being able to speak to the truth of what the HIV epidemic is and what it means to live with HIV, and to dispel myths and to give hope to people along the way. So, like I said, being able to say you can have the same medications that Magic Johnson has, so kind of dispelling that myth that, you know, poor people are somehow more supremely affected, and being able to give hope to people. And that's related to the last bullet point that I wish I could say more about because it was the foundation of my dissertation, but we'll leave it alone for now. But that is the importance of social support and peer support for people living with HIV. That's what I did my dissertation on, and so it could probably be a separate workshop, and Rick, we could talk about that. But just suffice it to say at this point that making sure that people living with HIV have strong social support and peer support, and when I say peer support, I mean connections with other people who are living with HIV and living well with HIV, maybe someone who has been, you know, diagnosed a long time ago, who can kind of come alongside them and kind of support them and give them hope along the way, can make a really big difference. Okay, so as we are unfortunately drawing close on time, let me get to the specific crises that HIV-positive individuals face. So you'll see, yeah.
Well, we do have till 2:15, so we do have a bit of time.
20 minutes, right?
Yes, yeah. But okay. I wonder, too, if you just want to pause for a couple of minutes and ask if anyone has questions that they'd like to ask.
I would love to.
For people figuring out how to do the Star 6 will have a chance to do that if they want. Maybe pause for a minute for folks, and if you'd like to bring a question, make a comment, that would be a perfect opportunity. And you know what I'm going to do, if you don't mind, Allison? I'm going to actually unmute everyone completely just for those folks that are finding that technology is frustrating or can't find the star in their phone. So there'll be a little bit of background noise, but just so we can make sure everyone who wants to have a say can have a voice.
Wonderful.
Sorry, I had to abandon that experiment. There's just too much background
noise. Yeah, there's
noise.
A lot of...
Yeah, we encourage anyone who did want to make a comment or ask a question at this point just to hit the *6 on their phone and have a chance to do that. I don't want to belabor it, Allison. Just want to make sure we didn't leave any voice unheard.
Yes, absolutely.
I have a comment.
Okay, wonderful.
I guess I just kind of wanted to speak about the education. I'm a CRCS counselor here in South Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kind of wanted to reinforce that education makes a huge difference, especially in the person's personal stigma. They come with their own reservations and their own ideas about HIV because either they're too preoccupied with other things going on and they don't have all the information available to them, so that when we do provide them with that educational information, they come out of our program feeling a lot more confident that they have more control over their self-determination. They feel so more empowered, and I just kind of wanted to support that statement about how important it is to be educated, especially down here in South Texas where they're also... that added pressure about their immigration status. And so a lot of people don't seek help because of their they'll be shunned extra being an illegal immigrant and also having HIV.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad to hear that you've kind of had that same experience. And I think you're absolutely right that people come into, especially at the time of diagnosis, I think, and that's actually our next point anyway, but especially at the time of diagnosis, so many people come in maybe thinking that they know something about HIV, but we later find out that what they knew was not really correct, or kind of having some preconceived ideas about what HIV is, and we've seen how that just supremely affects negatively, kind of how misinformation really affects people's ability to live with HIV well. So, yeah, I totally agree. And so let me say that related to this first bullet point on this next slide. And please, if anyone else has any other comments, feel free to hit *6 along the way. So this slide that we're looking at now has 5 bullet points that are really, it's certainly not an all-inclusive, exhaustive list, but it's kind of a list that I came up with of 5 of the most common HIV crises that I've seen people affected by. And so I'll just speak briefly about each one, probably spend the most time on this first bullet point, and that's diagnosis. So that's probably not surprising to folks that the point at which someone finds out that they're HIV positive for the first time tends to be a point of crisis. And so a couple things I want to say about that and related to some of what the previous comment was. And that is, remember, if we go back to discussion about rapid testing and that rapid testing process, it really changed the way that we in the field prepared people to receive their HIV diagnosis. One of the things that we instituted at the health center that I worked at was a question that I just found to be so critically important to preparing people for their diagnosis one way or the other. And that is, so we would finger prick them, and then during that 15-minute process, that 15-minute time frame that it took between when they were tested and when their result was ready, I would ask them a series of questions. My test counselors would ask them a series of questions. And one of the most important questions that we asked was we would ask them, on a scale from 1 to 10, with 1 being no chance at all and 10 being I absolutely expect it, what do you think the chances are that this test result is going to come back positive? And we would ask people to kind of rate that for themselves. 1, there's no way this is going to be positive. 10, I expect it to be positive. And I'll tell you that the reason that that question was so important and so powerful was really so that my test counselors, those social workers that were preparing people for diagnosis, could kind of gauge how ready the person was for their results. Because what we found is, you know, someone who says one, there's no way this test is going to be positive. Then the test counselor can kind of mentally prepare themselves for how they're going to go about giving someone a positive result, because it's very different than someone who expects it to come back positive. So it was a way for us to kind of prepare for that crisis intervention in advance a little bit. So that's one of the things I think is really important. And then I just want to say, and we could talk for hours just about this point, but I just want to say that if you find yourself working with a client in crisis because of a new HIV diagnosis, people ask me all the time, like, how do people respond to receiving that information? And I wish I could give you an answer, but unfortunately the answer is everyone responds differently. There are so many different reactions to receiving an HIV diagnosis. Some people are ashamed. Some people feel betrayed. Some people feel anger. Some people launch immediately into kind of loss and fear. A lot of people who say, you know, I'm afraid I'm going to die. And some reactions of guilt. And it can be any combination of those things and more. And so everyone's diagnosis is really, really different. And so, you know, we could talk for a very long time about that, but just wanted to kind of at least throw that out there. So diagnosis obviously is the first crisis that people living with HIV may face and that you may face with clients. But there are others that I just wanted to alert you to because they're the ones we don't think of quite as often. The first one is disclosure of status. What I mean by that is that a lot of people, they may have gotten through the initial crisis of being diagnosed with HIV, and then they face a second crisis. The first time they decide to disclose their status to someone else, especially the first time they decide to disclose their status to their family, to their maybe to their partner, to their spouse, to a mother or a father. A lot of times that disclosure, that conversation creates another point of crisis for people, maybe because the loved one didn't take it well. And so that's another kind of common thing that we sometimes have to help clients walk through. I've offered many times to be a part of that conversation with folks. So when I was working, you know, in HIV and clients would say, you know, I haven't told my mom, but I'm thinking about doing it, I would often offer, like, would you like to bring your mom in, you know, so that we could tell her together, so that I could kind of dispel those myths and answer those questions and kind of help facilitate that process. So that can be really helpful for people if you're in a position to kind of help facilitate that process. Then the next crisis point that some people face is deterioration of health. And what I mean by that, and it's sort of related to the next point as well, but is that they face crisis as they face deterioration of their own health, as kind of a new symptom comes up maybe. You know, maybe it's the first time that they are infected with, that they get pneumonia, which is often seen as a sign of kind of the progression of the disease. And so it kind of, a lot of times serves as a point of crisis for folks because it reminds them of their diagnosis. And so we have to help people kind of along the way. And that's related to that next point, which is going back to HEART. Remember, HEART stands for Highly Active Antiretroviral Therapy. And it's really just, it really just means starting medication. And so I wrote here that both beginning medication and failing a medication regimen are very common points of HIV crisis for folks. Beginning HEART because some people fear that when doctors get to the point where they start talking about putting them on medication, that's kind of the beginning of the end. And they may feel similarly, not everybody does, but they may feel similarly when they fail an HIV treatment regimen. And what I mean by fail, again, this gets into kind of medical terminology that we don't have time for. But the bottom line is all HIV medications eventually build up resistance. And so no one really stays on one HIV medication for their life. Most of the time they're on a regimen and it might be successful for a year or two or five, and then their bodies will slowly build up resistance to it and they'll fail the regimen. And so they have to switch regimens or, you know, kind of figure out a different solution. And a lot of times those kind of turning points with their treatment tends to put people back in crisis. And so I've had to work with lots of clients kind of working through that process as well. And then the last one says AIDS diagnosis. This is something that we haven't talked about previously, but an important distinction that many of you probably know, but probably not all, and that is that HIV and AIDS are not the same thing. So HIV is the virus. It just means you're infected with the virus. AIDS is the disease. And the long and the short of it is an AIDS diagnosis occurs when someone who is HIV positive, when their CD4 count, which is the measure of their immune system, drops below 200. It's a pretty strong benchmark, like demarcation in the sand, so to speak. And a lot of HIV-infected people kind of find themselves back in a point of kind of personal crisis the first time they're diagnosed with AIDS. Because, again, it can signify to people that it's sort of the beginning of the end, but it doesn't have to be the beginning of the end. And that's that opportunity part of danger and opportunity in working with people in crisis. And so you may find yourself, you know, needing to kind of educate people about the health outcomes for people even when they are AIDS diagnosed, and kind of helping to kind of reinstill that that hope that people really can live with this disease. So those are kind of the main HIV crises. I want to stop there because we only have about 9 minutes left, and I've just thrown a lot of information. And so, unfortunately, we're probably not going to get to a whole lot of my client stories, but that's okay. But I wanted to stop here and see if anyone has questions about any of those specific crises, if you have any comments about things that you've faced with clients and kind of want some feedback, or to talk a little bit about kind of the crises that you've seen. So I'll leave the floor open, so to speak, and I think we'll continue to leave everybody on mute, but anyone who has a comment could press star 6 if there are any questions about what I've said.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello? Yeah, as a substance abuse counselor, one of the crises I see that HIV patients go through is the crisis of just trying to stay sober. Because if you have an addiction, it's, you know, staying sober is difficult, and so they go through crises of staying sober and then relapsing and then feeling guilty for relapsing and then maybe going back to the detox and whatever. And I work with several patients in that situation, and it's just a very difficult thing for them.
Yeah, and so if you don't mind me asking, can you say a little bit about how you think HIV impacts that process for people? Like, how does being HIV positive make the substance abuse and relapse kind of process different, do you think?
Well, I think a lot of substance abuse certainly happens around medicating feelings or numbing feelings or avoiding feelings. So if they're going through the emotions and they're having a difficult time dealing with the emotions, then the substance is a good way to, not a good way, but a way in people's minds of being able to medicate that and self-treat that. So I think that's one connection there that I see a lot, and I think the other one would just be that, again, trying to kind of deal with a lot of things at the same time. Your body's going through all these issues, being HIV positive, you have all these health issues, and then you're trying to stay sober, and you probably have relationship problems and other things going on. It becomes a lot of burden for people.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think that that self-medicating kind of piece is probably very common for addicts who are also HIV positive. I think it's a really, really good point. And it becomes, and we face this, right, with dual diagnosis clients of any kind, right? So whether it's HIV and substance abuse, or substance abuse and mental health, or the triple diagnosed, substance abuse, mental health, and HIV, right, then it's like they have all of these crises that are going on at one time, and it becomes, which crisis do you treat first, right? And how do these how do these things, you know, kind of impact each other? Yeah, absolutely. It's a great point. That's a great point. Any other thoughts or comments or questions about working with HIV clients in crisis?
I have a question, Allison.
Yeah.
My name is Marisa Tinkham, and Crystal from Southern. We know each other because we went to the same school, so I just want to say hi to you briefly. But anyways, you had mentioned clients who had been involved with a faith group finding out about their diagnosis and some of the negative experiences that they had because people didn't understand it, or people rejected them because of their lifestyle choices or whatever. But I was just wondering if if you could just talk briefly on the spiritual implications.
Yeah.
Because I work for a therapy organization here in Atlanta.
Right.
That used to be faith-based, but now they're moving towards a more community-based model. But my husband is a pastor as well, so I think that the spiritual aspects are really important. And if you just have two or 3 minutes of experience with how you've dealt with that or counseled clients through that issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad that you asked that question because I saw that my time was running short and certainly wanted to address those. I think this is probably a great question to kind of wrap up on, so thank you. So I have a couple thoughts related to that. One is, one of the things that we know from the literature is that when you go back to thinking about crisis, danger, and opportunity, right, that opportunity piece, what we know from literature is that when there's a huge correlation between when individuals' health fails in any respect, this isn't HIV-specific research, right? It's true for cancer. It's true for anything. We know that when people's individual health fails them, that they are more inclined to be open to spirituality. It's all throughout the literature. It's a huge, huge opportunity for people. And so, like I said, that's not HIV-specific literature. That's just what we know about, you know, any major diagnosis, cancer, anything like that. And I think it's really, really important to understand that and to see HIV diagnosis as an opportunity, that churches would see that as potentially a group of people who are more open to thinking about their spirituality and to be open to, you know, religion and kind of the hope that religion can provide. That's my glass half full answer and approach. But I'll tell you that, not to be Debbie Downer, but that's not what I've seen the church do. It's not the stories that I hear from clients. One of the client vignettes that I was going to share that I didn't get to, I'll tell you just a little bit about him because he's typical of this conversation, was a client that I had. I was actually seeing him for mental health issues, and he was HIV positive and pretty severely depressed. And I remember talking to him, and I said to him, you know, tell me something that you enjoy doing. Like, when is the last time, I think I said the sentence to him, when is the last time you remember being happy? And he looked at me and he started to cry and he said, I used to love to sing in my church choir. Hmm. And I said, okay. And he said, and they won't let me sing in my church choir anymore. And he proceeded to share a story with me about this church that he grew up in, that he was super active in, and when they found out that he was HIV positive, they told him he wasn't allowed to hold any leadership positions anymore. He wasn't allowed to sing in the choir. They basically didn't want him to be visible. And this is not an individual incident. This is what we hear a lot of times in terms of how the church is treating folks. And I think that what that client taught me was the importance of kind of checking my own biases and assumptions about people living with HIV. And he was a gay man, a gay African-American man living with HIV. And it caused me to check myself and to realize that, yes, he's gay. Yes, he's HIV positive. But he still has this desire for connection to his church community. And I think that that's probably true for a lot of HIV positive folks, because we know that when faced with kind of end of life issues, it makes people more open to spiritual things. That's what I would say to your husband if he was on this call, right? Especially, like, I would love to talk to pastors about that and say, you know, churches really could be capitalizing on this opportunity instead of focusing on the danger and kind of pushing people away. So that's one thing that I would say. The other thing that I want to say just really briefly as we close related to that is, so the health center that I used to work at was a faith-based health center and a very kind of unapologetically faith-based Christian health center. You know, hugely a part of their mission, not trying to hide it at all. And so one of the things that I used to do, it was slightly controversial, but it proved to be incredibly powerful for me and for my work with clients, was when we would get new clients who would come in and when they would disclose homosexuality, when they would disclose that, I would stop and I would say some version of this. As you may know, this health center is a faith-based health center. You know, we're connected to, we're affiliated with a Christian church, and you know, we're all Christians, and this is what we believe. And I would stop the conversation at that point, and I would say, I don't know what your experience has been with the Christian church, but I want you to know that this is a safe place for you to talk. And I also want you to know that if you have been hurt by the church, I'm sorry. And I would just put it out there, and I would leave it there. And some people would choose to engage in a conversation about that and would tell me about, you know, their affiliation with church. And some people would never want to talk about it again. But even if they never wanted to talk about it again, I think that what doing that does is kind of start the reconciliation process for people.
Yeah.
And I just found that to be really, really important to kind of put it out on the table, to not have it be the big elephant in the room, but instead to just say, I know that the church has hurt people in the past. And if that's your experience, I'm really sorry. And that's not the experience that you're going to receive here from me. So, you know, depending on your setting, depending on, you know, kind of where you find yourself interacting with clients, it's just something I wanted to share to kind of get people thinking about kind of how to broach this subject, because it is a pretty touchy subject with a lot of folks. So those are kind of my thoughts. I hope that helps to answer your question.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, wonderful. So so at this time, we are at the end. And so unfortunately, we didn't get to those client stories, but that's all right. I could share client stories all day long. So I just flipped to this last slide so that you all could see it and know where to go for more information. I put my local agencies there on the bottom. They're Chicago sites, but Chicago has always sort of been at the forefront of the HIV epidemic, and so they're definitely websites you could go to for more information. So I hope that this audio conference has helped you all, and that you will just kind of think differently maybe about HIV, and that you'll be better equipped to kind of talk to people and the crisis that they face along the way. So thank you so much for your time. My email address is on the very first slide of this presentation, and you can feel free to email me any additional, you know, kind of questions or comments. I'd be happy to kind of continue to dialogue with folks.
Allison, let me take a moment just on behalf of NACSW to thank you for today's excellent session. I, like you, bemoan that we haven't had a chance to get to some of the vignettes, and I'd love to talk with you about ways that we can get some of those vignettes out, as I think it will help make information come alive that much more.
Sure.
So thank you so much for the great presentation today, and to all of you for participating in today's session.
We hope that you enjoyed this training. Please remember to take the post-test and the course evaluation in order to receive your CEU certificate. If you have any additional input or questions, please don't hesitate to contact us at the information you can find on our main webpage or email us at info@nacsw.org. We hope that you will consider taking additional courses on topics sensitive to the thoughtful integration of faith, spirituality, and social work practices through our program. Thanks again, and thanks for supporting NACSW.
Thank you for joining us today for NACSW's Podcast of the Month featured selection. We hope you found today's session useful and that it will support your efforts to ethically integrate Christian faith and social work practice. We also hope that you will consider participating in additional NACSW activities and events, such as NACSW's upcoming convention 2011 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, from October 20th to 23rd, our quarterly audio conference workshops that we offer at no cost to NACSW members, and access to dozens of archived podcasts from the member section of our website. Also, we invite you to join NACSW's Facebook group or our Facebook fan page. For additional information about these and other NACSW benefits and services, you can go to our website at www.nacsw.org. Thanks again for listening into our podcast session today.